Eduardo Machado's diet changed a lot after he left Cuba in 1961. He went from eating yuca and lime mojo to Spam and Velveeta cheese. Mm. In a memoir called Tastes Like Cuba, the playwright relates his story through the food he's eaten. It's published by Gotham Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought Eduardo Machado to my show today. Hello.
Hi, lovely to be here.
Does Cuba have a unique taste?
Does Cuba have a unique taste? Oh, yes, it has. This taste is the combination of Basque, French, and African cooking that makes it not as spicy as people think it's going to be, but it gives it a combination of all these interesting cultures when you're eating.
Now, most of the Latin American countries are a fusion of a whole bunch of different cultures.
Right.
But is it, to some degree, is Cuba because of the indigenous crops? Because the Dominican Republic should produce food that tastes just like Cuban food,
but it
doesn't.
You know, I think Cuban food is different because of the French influence, and I think it's because Cuba had so much more money. Starting in the 1600s, that their palate is just a little bit more refined.
Well, when you were growing up, although you left very young, were the staple dishes the same as the ones we see on the menus of Cuban restaurants here in New York City?
They weren't. They were mostly fish and very heavily Basque influenced. In my family, you know, Cuba was like Australia. All the Basques got sent there for being anarchists. So no, it was not at all like what you would normally see at a Cuban restaurant.
Now, most memoirists who use food as a way of telling their stories are people in the food world.
Right.
Playwright. Do you think that more memoirists could do an effective job using this as a way of
You know, the
talking
interesting thing
lives?
Has been when I've been traveling and talking to people that this book has enabled me to talk about the embargo in a way that my plays never allowed me to talk about why the embargo should end. And somehow through this food memoir, I've really been able to talk to people about the political issues that I want to talk about. You know, all the food part of the book was done by Michael Dmitrovich, who wrote the book with me. And sort of our criteria was, I felt that food in Miami had really coarsened, as their politics said. And so our test was, did it taste the way I remembered it? And once it tasted the way I remembered it, the recipe got into the book.
Well, then you went back to
Cuba.
And you could compare that, although I'm sure food has changed a lot over all the years.
Food has changed a lot in Cuba because of all the restrictions from the embargo, and they had to start cooking in a different way. There's a lot more vegetables, which Cubans hate.
That's good for them at the same time.
It's good for them, yeah. They have organic farming because they can't afford chemicals. Yes, I found the food that I remembered at this Paladar. This woman ran this Paladar, this black woman in her 70s, and it tasted as French and Spanish as I remembered Cuban food should taste.
Well, you are critical of U.S. policies, the embargo, and yet it is people who come out of the same class that you do, similar to your family, who are insisting on maintaining that embargo.
Yeah, I think that insisting on maintaining that embargo out of a great deal of hatred, a great deal of needing revenge, and refusal to believe that it didn't work. I think you have to go back and face Cuba, which not many of them do, in order to change your mind.
How old were you when the revolution began?
When Fidel won, I was 6, and I left when I was 8.
Were you? But your family sent you and stayed behind until they could also get out of the island?
Yes. They sent me with my brother, who was 5, to Hialeah to keep us from being communists. And then I became a Marxist in my later age, so it didn't work out
for
them
at all.
Well,
maybe that was your rebellion.
Yeah.
So, and then your family came over a few years later.
You're right. A year later.
Do you still feel like an exile 46 years
after? Yeah, I have a Cuban passport. I never became an American citizen, and neither did my brother. We're probably the only two Cubans that never became American citizens. And my brother's completely different than me. So I have a green card, and I have a Cuban passport. And I do feel like an exile. I do feel like I left without my approval. You know, of course, I go back there, and people would say, go back there and live. I can't, because they would never let me go back there and live because I left. And because I also feel American, but I do feel like an exile, you know.
Well, an awful lot of Cubans have told me that uh-huh. they feel like exiles, but then they admit that they wouldn't rush back if they had the opportunity, if the political situation changed, because they have just become too Americanized.
Well, you know, I write in English. My plays, I don't think I could write in Spanish, so I think I have become too Americanized to ever live there all the time.
But you didn't speak a word of English when you arrived.
I didn't speak a word of English. I learned English by watching I Love Lucy and the Patty Duke Show.
Of course, only watching Desi.
There were no second language things then in Canoga Park, California. You had to learn on your own. So that's how I learned, wanting to understand what they were saying.
Well, first you went to Miami. Who did you stay with?
My uncle and his wife, who had gone from being, they were 25, who had gone from being very rich kids to being very poor kids. My uncle cleaned cars for a living, and my aunt was becoming a Jehovah Witness. And we lived in this little track house in Hialeah. Lucky that he had enough money to afford that.
But you were also eating food that had little connection to Cuba. Don't most emigres try to duplicate the food?
We had no money. We had to live on army rations, so we lived on garbanzo beans, rice, and Velveeta cheese and Spam for a year.
Because that's what you were given.
That's what we were given. There was no welfare then. And that's what the Catholic Relief gave us, army rations. And that's what we lived on.
And then you also had your first experience with fast food at a White Castle.
Yes.
That must have been a culture shock.
My cousin came to visit us to hand me the family jewelry. And he had escaped from the Swiss embassy. And he had enough money to buy us a White Castle hamburger, which was heaven on earth at that moment.
I'm sure you go back all the time.
You know, I go back when I go to Louisville to do a play. They have one by the theater.
Your parents then joined you after a year, and uh-huh. you moved to Los Angeles.
We did.
The Catholic Church paid for that?
They paid for that. They paid for one-way tickets, and they set up a house for us.
Why would they do that?
Generosity.
I mean, they gave you a choice, New York, Los Angeles. And
they gave us a choice of New York, Boston, Los Angeles, and my dad picked Los Angeles. And they were trying to get Cubans out of Miami because they thought it was a real problem that so many Cubans were staying there, and the churches, other churches also were doing it, would sponsor a family, and they sponsored us.
And I'm sure you thought this was only temporary, that you were going to go back to Cuba within a year or so.
Yes, we did. We thought that for the first 11, 12 years. My mother still thinks that, yeah.
So your mother's never really adjusted to her new life?
No, my mother doesn't speak English, no.
To this day?
To this day, she doesn't speak English. I think she secretly does, but she pretends not to.
Well, she has to go shopping.
She lives in Miami now where you don't have to speak English.
In L.A., she mm-hmm. was moving from a relatively Cuban-dominated Hispanic culture to a mostly Chicano.
Yeah.
Did that mean that it was hard to find the right ingredients?
Oh, it did. We didn't know what a corn tortilla was. We thought tortillas were omelets. Everything was different, and my mother, you know, tried to mix Cuban and Mexican together. We had never seen a Haas avocado, for example, and my mother to this day doesn't believe it tastes any good.
So much better.
So much better. It took me a long time to admit that myself. And so it was always, you know, it was before Goya. It was always trying to find the ingredients, especially coffee, which we... At that time, there were no Starbucks or anything, so we were drinking Maxwell House, which my father said tasted like piss. And finally,
it wasn't good to the last drop.
No. Finally, we went to the Grand Central Market and found Italian espresso, and it was like God had come back to save us.
My guest is Eduardo Machado, who's written with Michael Dimitrovich, Tastes Like Cuba, An Exile's Hunger for Home, published by Gotham Books. So there you are in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. And then you discover New York. How old were you when you discovered New York?
I was 13 the first time I ever came to New York. And
that's when you fell in love with theater?
I have fallen in love with theater since I was a little kid, but I came here to live when I was 15 because I was supposed to go to Juilliard. But it was the time where all these planes were being hijacked to Cuba. And my father didn't let me get on a plane until he knew I wasn't going to go to Juilliard. Because the real plan was to send me to a psychiatrist friend of his here so I would stop wanting to be in show business. But instead, I got a job. They lied about my age. They fixed my birth certificate so I could get a job. And I got a job. And with any money I made from the job, I go to see plays. And I just completely fell in love with the theater. It backfired on him as did sending me here not to become a Marxist.
And then you met Harriet, which
then
I'm
met
sure.
Harriet, who was a Marxist,
and she was much older than you. Your father must have loved that.
Yeah. She was his age, and I was 18, and she was a leftist, and my mind completely changed. I was one of those Cubans who didn't see the reasons for the revolution, and didn't see why Fidel was justified. And it took me a long time, but I slowly started thinking a different way.
Well, do you really support Fidel Castro and the repressions of that regime? I mean, couldn't there have been a socialist revolution of some sort that,
well, that could have been
wouldn't
a socialist
have jailed
revolution.
Anybody who disagreed?
Well, I think...
And throw homosexuals into jail?
I think the first 10 years of Fidel Castro were completely necessary. The other 33 are highly questionable. But I do think that Cuba, as an example of being on your own without needing the United States, is something to be proud of. No, Fidel's a dictator, you know. But you know, real Marxists think that Fidel's a dictator. But the trying to change, to not end up like Jamaica, which was what Cuba would have ended up like, and it didn't, I think, was something worth evolving. It has not evolved as fully as one wishes. Maybe now it will.
Part of your adjustments are you actually abandoned Cuban food for a while.
Then
you married Harriet,
mm-hmm.
then broke up with Harriet
uh-huh.
because you discovered that you were becoming more interested in men.
Yeah.
Something that you could not have done in Cuba, by the way.
Well, yeah, you could. You can now. I mean, do you know how they actually solved it? Because I stayed with a lot of people who were blacklisted and put in camps during Fidel's thing. They took them to court. And on a technicality, isn't this fascinating? On a technicality, they had to end the persecution, which I find fascinating.
Well, the great poet and writer Arenas, what was his first name?
Reynaldo.
Reynaldo, many years ago after he had come here, he told me that a colonel from the military came to his home and said, stand up and walk across the room, walk back. He said, you're going to a camp to be readjusted, or you can leave on the Mariel boat lift, and he chose to leave.
Yeah.
Wrote a semi-autobiographical play, The Modern Ladies of Guanabacoa.
Uh-huh.
How did your family react to that?
Well, they pretended it wasn't happening because it was happening in New York. When it was done in L.A. and there was a picture of my grandmother the size of a wall. My father hated my plays. My mother loved them. And The Modern Ladies of Guanabacoa is about my mother's family. So I think she was actually proud of me. Although she would never say it. My father never saw any of my plays. He was so infuriated by them.
To the end.
To the end, yeah.
Well, I'm sure that your relationship with your father is really has played a major role in how you have lived your life and trying to figure yourself out as a man and as a playwright and everything else.
I think I became a playwright to tell my father how I felt. And, of course, he never saw them or read them, so it did, however, give me a life that I didn't think I was going to have when I was an actor.
You live here now.
I live here now.
Is there good Cuban food in New York?
You know, there's a restaurant that I think is really good, 46 and 6, called Havana Central. The one in 46, I think, is the best one. They have two other ones. And then there's this really wonderful place at 125th and Broadway called Mi Floridita, which is a counter, a big counter. But I think those two places are really great. It's hard to find good Cuban food.
Well, people can also cook it from your book.
Yes.
And we have posted a recipe for the plantain omelet on our show page at wnyc.org. I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Welcome.
You have another play in the works?
I just have a play called The Cook that just closed at the Goodman Theater, and it's still running.
But that's Chicago.
Rep. I know. In New York, I'm not going to have a play until next year. I'm directing a play that Michael Dmitrovich wrote called Art ... because I don't think I can say the word, which opens in February at the Daryl Roth, too.
And I appreciate you not saying that word.
Yeah.
Eduardo Machado with Michael Dmitrovich, written Tastes Like Cuba and Exile's Hunger for Home, published by Gotham Books. Thank you so much for being
with
us.
Thank you for having me.